Welcome to the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast, where you'll hear from inspirational female leaders who are real models as well as role models. Our guests on this show have one thing in common. They are passionate about supporting all women to achieve success. Here's your host, Amanda Alexander, multi-award-winning coach and founder of the Academy for Talented Women.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast.
Today I am interviewing Sue Lawton, MBE. Sue is a global expert on women and enterprise. She creates business opportunities for women entrepreneurs and she's a founder of WeConnect Europe, establishing the WeConnect International Programme around the world. WeConnect is a global charity and it connects women business owners with corporate contract opportunities, something that traditionally women have found difficult to do. Sue's also worked extensively with underrepresented communities around the world, including the US, Canada, Australia, Turkey, and Belize. And she continues as an advisor to WeConnect International and also to WIP International, whose mission is to build powerful collaborative networks among leading women-led organizations. And she does that to help them leverage their joint power to negotiate for policy and economic solutions to help women to achieve economic independence and participate fully in their country's economic growth. Sue is also currently working with the Secretariat of the UN High Level Panel on Women's Economic Empowerment, and I'll be asking Sue about this during the interview. She holds an MA and is a special advisor to the APPG for Women and Enterprise. She's a fellow of the RSA and a trustee of the Commonwealth Girls Education Fund. And she's been awarded an MBE for services promoting women's business leadership worldwide. So an absolutely wonderful podcast guest and really, really privileged to be interviewing you. Thank you for being here today, Sue.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So Sue, I was just asking you before I said, are you a mum? And you said, yes, I have two boys aged 36 and 38. So they have obviously flown the nest now, but I just wanted to really start at the beginning and how you started your career.
I started my career as a social worker, so I've always had a social conscience. I came from an area of Lancashire that was not very affluent. I did not pass my 11 plus, so went to a secondary modern school, which took me a long time to then catch up academically. But I was in school with lots of deprived children, and it made me realise there was much social work to be done. So, social worker.
I remember the secondary modern system, and it was, the perception was, it's either grammar school or secondary modern, and if you get into secondary modern, then, you know, your life is over, you are doomed.
That's absolutely correct. It took me until I was 16 and a lot of determination to finally be able to transfer from a secondary modern to a grammar school. But it was funny, once I got into the grammar school, I then went to an all-girls Catholic convent grammar school, and it was completely different. So instead, I applied to do a year as a foreign exchange student in America. And instead of doing upper six, I went and did 12th grade in an American high school, which was a very interesting experience, as my mum and dad in the UK didn't even own a telephone, so we didn't speak for a year. So when I see young people going off for their gap years now, being extremely exciting and brave with their mobile phones and using Skype, I keep thinking back about my old mum who didn't get to talk to me for 12 months.
You must have been thinking, you don't know your born with your Skype and your computer and your instant messaging.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't take anything away from them. They're travelling further probably than I did. But it was still a pretty brave thing to do, I thought, at the time.
Very brave. And I'm just interested in, so what happened? You went to secondary modern, so you got that big red X against your name for going to secondary modern.
Oh, yeah.
But somehow between the age of 11 to the age of 16, something quite significant must have happened for you to have had that determination to say, I'm not doing this, and to have moved schools and really pulled yourself up. What happened there?
Well, I think I'm just a born optimist. I failed my 11 plus. It took me years. It took me till I was 60 to get over that one, which is why I'm a great believer in the comprehensive school system. But I never lost the belief that actually I should have passed my 11 plus. Why didn't I do that? And how dare they not choose me to go to grammar school?
Oh, good for you. But I guess that you were unusual in that.
Yeah, most of the children that I went to school with, in fact, left at the age of 15. There were just a few solitary souls left by the time we got to be 16. Mm. And very few went on to a college of further education. In fact, I was the only one who then carried on to the girls' grammar school.
Sue, have you seen a video that has been one of those viral videos? And I came across it just the other day. And I'm not quite sure who it is, but it's set in a courtroom. And he is making an argument for the education system to really pull itself up and to start being far more innovative, saying the education system is failing children, and look at all the changes that are going on in the world, and yet the education system is staying the same. And it starts off, it's a fantastic image. It starts off with a goldfish in a bowl saying that essentially what an education system does now, pretty much throughout the world, apart from places like Finland, is to say to a goldfish, right, you will get graded on whether you can climb this tree. Have you seen that?
No, but I think I should.
Yeah, I'll have to send you a link to it, and I'll put a link in the show notes to it, because I think it's very relevant to how the education system fails people at a young age by putting them in boxes and judging them by norms that certainly, well, most probably shouldn't be norms anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the difficulty is it takes some people a little bit longer to learn how to operate within the education system. So I did end up finally, years later, getting two master's degrees, but it took me a bit longer than it would have taken most people. But it did mean that I truly appreciated the opportunity to get my master's degrees, and I'm hugely proud of them.
And your master's degrees, you have one in social enterprise, is that right?
Yep. The first one was in human resource management, and the second one is in social enterprise management and development. So, in fact, returning back to my social work origins in wanting to do social business to help community growth.
And when did you do that social enterprise MA?
That one would have been in about 2003.
Okay. And were you still a social worker at that point?
No. I stopped being a social worker after the first 4 years of my working career. At that time, when you had a baby, you left work. So I left social work with the thought that I may return at some point. Mm-hmm. But in fact, life took many other turns and many other opportunities. And although I still maintain my interest in community growth, I never returned to the specific role as a professional social worker.
Okay, so what happened then? You'd left work because that's what you had to do, and that was your first son. And then I guess 2 years later, your second son came along. Were you still not working?
20 months later, yeah, I still wasn't working. But very shortly after that, I met somebody who was working for the publishing house, Usborne Publishing, which I loved their books. I was a convert to their wonderful books even before I had anything to do with them. And they were wanting to set up a direct sales arm because they felt that women who had children could not get into bookshops because access with prams was difficult, or the children's bookshop section was probably upstairs. And they wanted a way whereby the mothers particularly could really look at the books and decide if they were the relevant books for their children, rather than just buy something random quickly and have made a wrong choice. So I was asked if I would help in the trial to set up a direct sales arm. And I did, and that grew into a full-time career, which became Usborne Books at Home.
Gosh, which we all know and love today. I mean, Usborne Books is still going as At Home, aren't they?
Still going strong, yeah. And Usborne Books at Home is still going strong. But when I started, there were just three of us. When I left 15 years later, there were 3,000, majority of women, a few men, direct selling Usborne books. But the joy of that was that it was my introduction to working with women-owned businesses. Because what we were essentially doing was offering those women an opportunity to build their own business around the product of an Usborne book. And so it was 15 years of learning how to work with women, how to get them to grow their confidence, to be professional, to grow their business to the size that they wanted it. Some remained very, very part-time. Others made very successful full-time jobs about being Usborne organisers with a full team underneath them. So a very interesting experience and also a great learning opportunity for me to work with women entrepreneurs.
And of course, direct selling is absolutely huge today, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I like to think that Usborne have maintained a culture of not direct pressure selling, but offering the customer the opportunity to see a hugely high quality product and making a reasoned choice if this is the product for them to buy. But what it also did, you know, we talked about before about the 11 plus and going to the grammar school. Whilst I was working with Usborne, Peter Usborne always said, if you don't know it, learn it. Mm-hmm. We're not going to bring in outside experts. Go away and learn it. And a lot of the training and development fell to me. So I put myself through my IPD, Institute of Personnel Development, to do the official qualifications, and then built on that to get my master's in human resource management. And in fact, the dissertation was on women returners and how do they go back into the workplace, but built really around that experience of working with Usborne. So thank you to Usborne for the opportunity.
Wow. So two things I want to ask you. Where shall I go first? I wanted to ask you, you said that led into your introduction to women in entrepreneurship. And you also mentioned your MA and having done your MA with the subject of women returners. What were the key, let's go to the MA first. What were the key findings of your research for your MAs with helping women return to work?
Well, it was interesting. Obviously, a lot of it was around the fact that women felt that they had lost their skills when returning into the workplace. Mm-hmm. But one of the most interesting things that I found was that I did some in-depth interviews with line managers or business owners who were bringing these women in to work for them. And the ones who were the toughest against the women were actually the females, because they would say, come 3:30, I know that this woman is not concentrating on her work because she's worrying if her children are okay. Whereas the men were very, very open to giving those women opportunities. I like to think that it has changed since then and everybody's got an equal opportunity, because that's what we've been working for. But in the 1990s, there was an element of women not being as supportive as they could have been.
Oh, do you know what, Sue? I'm afraid it looks as if things haven't changed as much as we might have hoped. I was reading an article the other day with some research showing that there's still that perception that women would rather work for another man than for another woman. And it was also a study done about how some women will undermine and sabotage other women because they feel that it was talking about a culture of scarcity rather than abundance. You know, if I've made it, then I need to keep this to myself.
Yes. But did they also do the other study that men would prefer to work for a woman or for a man?
Ah, now that's interesting.
So if you reverse the question, it'd be interesting to know, wouldn't it, whether it's actually women wanting to work for women or nobody wanting to work for women, or men would actually prefer to work for a woman because the culture is different.
Yeah, that study needs to be done.
I think so. There's one for you, a challenge for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Have you heard the Madeleine Albright quote, there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women?
Yeah, but my favourite quote is the Laurel Thatcher Ulrich one that says, well-behaved women seldom make history.
I think my mum's got something like that with women with tidy houses seldom make history, or something similar. Okay, so with your when leaving Usborne after working for Usborne for 15 years, that was your kind of next step into working with women entrepreneurs. What happened then?
It was. I chose to leave Usborne because my boys were 15 and 17. Mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of international travel with his job, and neither of us were at home. And I felt, even more importantly than when they were very small, that one of us needed to be there through that GCSE A-level trauma. Mm-hmm. So I decided to take a little time out and think about what else I would want to do. And so I took 6 months off, but I did stay at home with the children, well, young men as they were, but it was the opportunity came to go and work with women returners courses in the Hertfordshire area where I live. So running courses for women wanting to come back into the workplace, running some courses for women wanting to return into management positions, having taken time out, but also to do some adult guidance work in the local communities. So you have young people who can go to the youth programs to look at what do I want to be when I leave school. But these programs were geared up for women and for men who wanted to think about how they made the wrong career choices and how could they change where they wanted to be and move into a different direction. So a whole mixture of careers counseling, women returning, management building, that whole thing, but very much in my introduction to being self-employed and doing what I wanted to do.
And how long did you do that for?
I did that for a couple of years, and then we moved to America. And we moved to California, but I didn't have a green card. So it meant that I couldn't officially legally work. So I took two jobs. One, I worked in the local coffee shop, because that way I got to know everybody, and they paid me in Blue Mountain coffee and sushi. And the other one, my great love, is to go and be a good theatre audience. I don't want to be on the stage. I'm very happy to be in the audience. So I took a job as an intern in the local professional theatre, selling the Shakespeare courses to all the schools. And we sold them all out in 2 weeks because I had an English accent. It made selling Shakespeare very easy in California.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's really interesting listening to your career because it's not a traditional career. You've gone from being in a senior position for Usborne Books and setting up a business that has grown hugely to doing work self-employed with people in career transitions to working at a coffee shop for coffee, sushi, and an intern.
It gets better. When we came back 18 months later, I was, of course, an intern. And I was, again, thinking, what can I do? And I thought, I need some thinking time. Where was the safe place to go and think? So I went and sold frocks in John Lewis for 6 months. It was a wonderful job. It was a great time for me to stand back and think, what do I want to do next? So I did that for 6 months. And then I took on a job with a local borough council who were doing an outreach program for hard to reach communities, mm-hmm. that being women, ethnicity, youth, and social enterprise, mm-hmm. to give them business development advice so that they could start to grow their business. And these were the people who would have been redlined by a bank, who would not go into a business link office because it's such an alien space for them. And so to build up that program, and that went extremely well. It went so well, in fact, that we spun it out of the Borough Council and created a charity called InCredit. So we offered microcredit for businesses to be able to start up their business. And this was before microcredit was really becoming the in thing to do. So we would go into women's prisons and do enterprise training for the women serving the prison sentences, because if you've been in prison, nobody's going to give you a job. We'd also go into schools and get the young people to set up social enterprises that made a profit that returned into the school to teach them business skills and also to give them some social responsibility. And we worked with ethnic minority groups. Many of the women would not be comfortable to come out of their social environment, but that didn't mean they couldn't create a business within their community. So we did that as well. And that was a very entertaining, challenging, and rewarding time of my life.
It sounds incredibly rewarding, and it sounds like it was must have been a real grounding to you moving into the work that you do now, particularly with the high-level panel on women's economic empowerment.
Absolutely. It gave me a very good insight into the challenges. But I did that for a while, and then I thought there must be something harder. There must be a more difficult way for women leading their lives. So I handed the charity on to a very worthy successor and moved to Belize in Central America. I chose Belize. It was the only English-speaking country in Central America, and I speak no Spanish. So I went for 4 months in a voluntary role and mentored the CEO of the Women's Issues Network of Belize. So lived in Belize City in a very interesting house. We had cold water and rats, but that was fine, and some highly entertaining experiences. But I learned a lot, and I owe a lot to the women of Belize for helping me learn the challenges that they were facing that have humbled me and served me well in the years since then.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you found and what you learned from them?
Well, I think some of them were my perceptions of how safe was I going to be in this country that has a reputation for violence. Mm. I mean, it can be quite violent. Our offices were up a side street, and there was a gang house next door. And one day they tried to burn down the gang house, not successfully. But when we called the fire brigade, it was lunchtime, and the fire brigade were out at lunch. And another day they did a drive-by shooting, but fortunately we'd all just left the office. So there are stories like that, but there are also stories. I was on the bus the first day. There are no bus stops in Belize. You just stick out your arm and hope that the bus will stop. And the buses are old American school buses, the yellow ones, all with cut seats and big reggae music rocking out. And I'm on the bus for the first time, and I'm the only white person on the bus. And there's a man next to me with long rasta hair, no shoes on, and a big knife. And he looked at me, and I thought, well, everybody told me I would be dead in the first week, and they're going to be absolutely right. And he looked at me and he said, there's a seat here. Would you like it? I thought, oh, shame on me. Never judge anybody. And I never did again, and got on extremely well with all my friends in Belize, local ones particularly. So lots to learn. Never make a first impression judgment. See what's really the situation.
Absolutely. What were the sort of problems that women in Belize had? And how did they have any semblance to the sort of problems that we have as women in the Western world?
Well, the problems that I felt were the most difficult ones were for the schoolgirls. Mm-hmm. There in Belize at that time, I can't speak for the situation now. This is 2006. Okay. AIDS was absolutely rampant. Mm. And young girls, if they wished to stay in school, if they came from poor families, would take on a sugar daddy. So that sugar daddy would pay for their schooling, but in return would expect unprotected sex. And then if the girl got AIDS, then she'd be passed down the food chain, as it were. And that's no way to start your school life. You know, you've got ambitions for yourself. You want to stay in school, but the only way you can stay in school is to sell your body. It has improved in Belize since then, because obviously the economy in Central America has improved. But I was in Uganda earlier this year looking at women's economic empowerment and worked from the slum areas right through to the high-end businesses. And in the slum areas, the position's no different. It's the same in many, many countries still, where women cannot get forward because they have no empowerment. They have no control over the money. Any money is given for education is preferably given to a boy if there's a boy and a girl in the family. And the girls have no way forward. And when they try, there's many obstacles in their way. It's still a man's world, I'm afraid, in many countries.
It is. It is a man's world. Could you tell us more about what you're doing to try to improve the situation, particularly if you could tell us about your work with the UN and the High-Level Panel on Women's Economic Empowerment?
Well, the High-Level Panel was set up by Ban Ki-moon because he felt that as he came towards the end of his time as the Secretary General, he had not done enough for women's economic empowerment. Although I have to say in his defence, he had done a lot already. But he wanted to leave a legacy of action that would change women's lives. So he created a high-level panel made up of experts from all different aspects of women's lives from all around the world. It's chaired, co-chaired by the president of Costa Rica and by the chair, by the CEO of IKEA for Switzerland, so very diverse. And it's got representation from Christine Lagarde on it, Jim Yong Kim from the World Bank, Elizabeth Vasquez from We Connect International, Mozilla's represented on it, but then also UN Women, Oxfam. So the whole representation of women's lives, and they're coming together to put together action plans that will make a difference, that could be put into any economic environment to change the economic development for women. So they've had the first 12 months, and a report has just been published. And the first report is really a review of what is going on around the world, what's the situation for women's economic empowerment. And that was handed over to Ban Ki-moon in September at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York. But we're now going into the more important phase, which is what actions are going on around the world that we could share that will make a difference to women anywhere. So an example of a practical thing, in Costa Rica, when they're laying all the sewer pipes, they're having all the cables laid for IT connectivity so that women in rural areas can start to connect to the world and hopefully build business and economic opportunity for themselves. It doesn't lie there yet. It's growing. But they've got the vision to do that. Now, it sounds a very simple thing, but if that were done in all countries around the world, because women have far less connectivity to the global internet than men do, then economic growth for women must come from that. So very simple solutions that you would think, well, actually, that's a no-brainer, but it's not happening around the world. And if you go across women in agriculture, women in finance, women in developed societies, women in emerging economies, there's lots of good examples that we've not put together and used. And that's the challenge for the panel. And their second report, which will be the actions recommendations, will come out in June of next year.
And connected to that, how important do you think, or from your work with the panel, is the digital economy to women's empowerment throughout the world?
Oh, hugely. Because, I mean, if you look at banking in Africa, let's use the M-Pesa phone as an example. In the UK or in developed economies, we use traditional banking methods. But in emerging economies, we've skipped a whole process by going straight onto telephone banking. So it's changed lives, whereas many people have got a mobile phone now. As those mobile phones become technically enabled, it opens up the world of business. You know, if you say to a woman business owner or any business owner anywhere, have you got a global business? And they say, no, I've just got a little local business. Have you got a website? And many of them have. Then what does www. stand for?
Exactly.
World Wide Web. And that means worldwide opportunity. So if we can work with the women to get them to think about business growth, to understand the opportunities that having simple things like a website so that the rest of the world knows they are there, yeah. how they can grow their business. It's happening in developed economies already, but there's still so much more to do in the emerging economies. And there's so much opportunity there. If the world needs growth, you know, as the economist said, forget India, China, and the internet, economic growth will be driven by women.
Yes. Do you have the statistics behind that? I'm sorry if I'm putting you on the spot by this, but I find it a really interesting statement.
They do exist. They do exist. And I suppose if I had half a day, I could root them out for you.
Yeah. But that is it, I guess, for the naysayers who say every time International Women's Day comes about in March, they say, why do we need International Women's Day? Actually, that's a good question to ask Sue Lawton, MBE, Global Expert on Women and Enterprise.
Well, I think it depends where you live. I am a great believer in equality, and I think equality is equal balance. You know, we talk about feminism, but we don't talk about masculinism. Mm. But I do think that the time is right for developed economies to work collaboratively together to make an equal society. So that's one thing. In developing economies, it's much, much more of an imbalance. And if International Women's Day is international, we're not only talking about the women in developed economies who have made the first steps on the journey to equality. Some of the women in the developing economies haven't even started the journey yet.
Yes, there's so many women in developing economies who have so few rights. They're not, you know, they haven't, as you say, it's not even on the first rung of the ladder, is it?
They have no land rights. They have no banking rights. They have nothing.
Are you hopeful for the UN panel to actually make a difference across the world? It seems like such a huge call to action.
It does seem like a huge call to action, but if you don't take the first step on the journey, you're never going to make the journey, are you?
Absolutely.
And I am very supportive of what they're doing, because this is not just a report, not just another wonderful launch of a document that's going to sit in a cupboard and gather dust. Mm. This is actually a whole set of actions, and they're going to be measurable actions, so that having been called to the challenge, the countries can be called to account. Have you succeeded? And if not, why not? And that is the power of the UN.
Mm. What do you think we should be doing in the UK to support that?
Well, there's lots of things going on around the high-level panel. There is a website which I will give you to put up when you put this recording on, so that you can see the web link for it. But there's also lots of things going around women's economic empowerment within the UK. There are groups that you can join. It depends what floats your boat. Mm. You know, do you want to get involved with local women's groups, or do you want to get involved in the whole global picture for women's development? So it really depends where you're coming from. I think for women's economic empowerment globally, there are things like UN Women, who are very active in the UK. For business development, there's BPW, Business and Professional Women. There's quite a lot of these groups out there. You just have to look for them. Mm. Or ask me.
We will. I will get some resources from you, if that's okay. So that would be really good.
Yes.
One of the things that's in the call to action from the report is about women and housework. And it was, hang on, I've looked at it here, about the failure to recognise, reduce and redistribute unpaid household work and care. Mm. What do you think can be done about that? Because that's very much an attitude and very much related to tradition and, you know, gender roles, isn't it?
Well, it also depends, again, which country are you living in. If you're living in Africa, for example, and you have to walk 2 hours to get the water every day, then that's your responsibility, because it's not the man's job to go and get the water. So if you're spending 4 hours a day just going backwards and forwards collecting water, then what can be done about that? Bring water to the village and the woman gets 2 hours, 4 hours a day extra in which to develop her business. I think in developed economies, it's all about the negotiation, isn't it? You know, there's lots of programs around. There's in Australia, there's a thing called Male Champions for Change, mm-hmm. which is the male business leader saying we're supporting women and we think this should be an even balanced thing. There's He for She, but it's also down to women to negotiate what is acceptable for them personally. And I think traditionally, you know, women have had that majority of care and responsibility, and some women prefer it that way. That's a very personal choice. But I do think that perhaps as mothers, I like to think that I brought my boys up to think that it's their responsibility just as much as their partner's responsibility to care for their home, for their children. As their wives go out to work, of course it's an equal split, and so should it be. So I think it's about societal attitude and talking about it and having an expectation that if it's not being fair, shared equally, that is not acceptable. Mm. And some of that's going to be peer pressure, isn't it? So I'm a great believer in getting male champions to help us fight the fight for equality. I'm going back to this thing that it is equality. It's not necessarily feminism. It's about an equal, balanced society and balanced both ways.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you, Sue. And I've been thinking a lot lately about how we need to help men to understand, just coming closer to home, sort of focusing on the UK for a moment, how we need to get men to understand why gender equality will help all of us. I think there's still a misconception. If you asked the man on the street about gender equality, the answer you would get was, oh, it's all about those bra-burning feminists. We've got gender equality. It's my wife who rules the roost at home.
Just shows how much more we've still got to do. Not
but it's true, isn't it?
It is true. I do know what you're saying. But it isn't correct, is it? If you speak to the women, that's not the message that I'm hearing. And it is about that equal choice. So that if a woman chooses to make to build a career, then she's supported in that, and that society supports the childcare needs. But that it's also the male partner's responsibility to have childcare support, to take some of those days off when his wife or partner needs to work. And it works vice versa. You know, it's what you do for your best friend, isn't it?
Yes. And I think with shared parental leave, there's certainly a shift there, but we still need to give men permission to take it.
Absolutely. Because if you look, I think it's Japan, but correct me if I'm wrong, where the parental leave on paper is very generous, but society shames the men who take the paternity leave. So on paper, it's great. In practice, it doesn't work.
Okay, so it's like the, yes, you have this many days leave, but nobody in this company takes their full allocation of leave.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's one thing doing the paper exercise, but the cultural exercise may be different.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And talking about culture, just going again, reducing the focus to individual companies, there is so much focus now on talent attraction and talent retention, and companies are increasingly employing talent directors to support gender equality, equal numbers of men and women on boards, etc., etc. However, what I'm noticing is there's often a lot of talk and very little walk. Has that been your perception as well, or have I just been looking at the wrong places?
Well, you're probably in a better position to comment than I am, because I tend to look at what happens to the glass door rather than the glass ceiling. So I've been working in the women entrepreneurs' access to procurement contracts. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look around the world, women are 1% of the global supply chain. Mm-hmm. Now, they're more than 1% of the businesses. So there's an imbalance going on here. But if you look at the UK, we don't measure how many women business owners there are. We don't actually accurately know. There's no question on the business tax return that says, are you a male-owned business or are you a female-owned business? So one, we don't have the data. In the USA, they do have that data. And as a result of that, they have they measure the number of contracts, of federal contracts and of corporate contracts that go to women-owned businesses, mm-hmm. and try to redress the balance. It could be that that woman-owned business is not a big enough business, or the better business is male-owned, but at least they're beginning the opportunity to bid. That's not happening around the rest of the world, particularly in the UK, which is of my interest. So there's a glass door as well as a glass ceiling. So I think within corporates, I do see a lot of diversity discussion and a lot of women's groups within large corporations and what appear to be very flexible working practices. So perhaps you're better to comment on how successful those are being. What I'm not seeing is the opportunity for women entrepreneurs to be as successful as male-owned businesses to bid for those contracts, mainly because half the time they don't know when those contracts are coming up because it's a closed shop.
Well, speaking personally, so I certainly wouldn't know how to bid for a contract. And I have been involved in a couple of proposals with other women over the years of my business. And I say, you know, just a couple. And the experience was so traumatic and the information required, it was just, you know, beyond the size of our business. The questions on the proposals are like, well, what's this about? I don't have this, you know, whatever it was, or all, you know, various questions that presuppose that you're already a business of a certain size.
And insurances, they're totally unnecessary.
Yeah, it is. And then, I guess, and I'm sure you must know about this, we were successful in getting interviews and presentations, and we in both instances, and wow, yes, really impressed with you, great fresh ideas. And then after all that, and after us having spent a significant amount of our non-existent budget on, you know, traveling to these meetings, etc., etc., oh, we've decided to stay with the incumbent.
Yes. It's difficult, isn't it? But this is where organisations like We Connect International are there to help you. Because you, as one business, being upset about the processes are not going to be heard. But if you have many voices together, then you have the opportunity to make a difference. Mm. And it's about bringing those voices together. If you look at the work of WIP, which is Women Impacting Public Policy in the USA, they really tackle the problems around access to contracts, particularly from the federal procurement perspective. And they will do things like on the same day, at the same time, they will lobby every senator of every state on the same subject. Now, that's powerful.
Wow, that is.
We need to get organised, Amanda. Somebody needs to take control of this.
Yes.
And maybe this is where the Women's Equality Party will come in. Who knows?
You know, I was going to ask you about the Women's Equality Party. Have you joined?
I was sort of hanging around the edges because my interest is enterprise and they're only just forming their enterprise policy. So I have spoken to them very recently. So I have a lot of hope for the development of their enterprise programs. The thing that impressed me most was that their desire to work collaboratively with other parliamentary parties to make change for women, mm. rather than working as a competitor.
Yes.
And that's the bit that I think needs to be put over even more strongly. I didn't understand that bit until I actually sat down and spoke with them a couple of weeks ago. And now I think I'm a convert.
They're a political party who aren't political.
Absolutely. They're an influencing, lobbying. And if the other political parties aren't going to do it, then they're going to have to do it themselves type of party.
It'd be interesting to see what influence they do have on women in business moving forward.
Well, they've got their first conference taking place in Manchester at the end of November. And I'm hoping that enterprise will be part of the policy discussion. So watch this spot, really. Mm. And you were saying, how can women get involved? Well, if you're interested in enterprise developments, go and lobby the Women's Enterprise Party and build up a movement within that already converted, like-minded space.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, very good idea. Thank you very much. Sue, there was a question I wanted to ask you before, and we're bringing it right back from women's enterprise and lobbying and politics. And it's a personal question, and it's about the qualities that you have developed or used to create this fascinating career with so many different unexpected paths. I've noticed that, I mean, you talked about determination. We talked about determination at the beginning with the 11 plus and moving away from the secondary modern school. But you've told me all these different exciting twisty turny bits to your career. And I noticed you said things like, oh, and an opportunity came up to do this. Oh, and then this, somebody asked me to do this. And I'm kind of putting myself in the shoes of the listeners of a woman who might be in middle management. She feels like she's on this treadmill. She's not very happy with her current career where she is. People say you should stay where you are because you're onto a nice, easy number because they've given you flexible working. Just keep your head down, even though you don't like it and you don't get on with your boss. And she doesn't have time. And she's thinking, well, how on earth do opportunities like this come up? What would you say to that woman?
I would say she needs to go out there and create them. She needs to go and build her network of who does she know, who's working in another organisation, and when are their jobs coming up. It's about looking, deciding what you want, but being flexible about that. So say she's decided she wants change, but she doesn't know what change looks like. So the way to develop that is to go out and meet perhaps with other women and men who are working in other organisations, perhaps in the same sector if that's what you want to stay within, but building your network of connections and listening and looking and then looking for that opportunity and then voicing the desire to be somewhere else. Is there a job going at your place? I'm very happy where I am, but if an opportunity came up, I would be very interested to talk to you.
Okay, so networking is key there.
Yeah, believe in yourself, sell yourself a little bit and remain flexible at all times.
Okay, I like that. Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here because I've known so many women who are just completely stuck in a rut, and their response to this would be, I don't have time to go networking. My boss will not let me out to go networking. What would you say to them?
They don't work 24/7. And it depends how determined they are to get out there. I mean, some of these networks are professional networks that exist outside of the working day. Well, if you're too tired when you've got finished business, then you're not going to do anything, are you? You know, a change is as good as a rest. Get out there, talk to people, find out what's going on the other side of the fence. Who knows, you might decide it's actually quite nice on your side of the fence when you have a good look. But at least go out there and take a look. Yeah. And ask and talk and listen.
Okay, so it's just about, you need to get out there, you've got to look at what's important. If it's really this important, then create the time, get creative about it to start looking for those opportunities.
Absolutely, do something about it, don't just moan.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, one of the things that I always say is you don't necessarily have to start networking in person. We have such an incredible resource in social media and enabling us to network, you know, wherever we are.
Yeah, and you know, and a lot of people say, oh, I don't like networking, it's not what I do. And then don't network, just go and have a chat.
Yeah,
You don't have to call it networking.
Yeah, I agree.
Just talk to people. They're quite nice, really.
Yeah. Networking is one of those words that fills people with dread. I run Forward Ladies meetings once a month in Manchester. I'm the regional director for the Northwest. And I always say to new people, because I see them coming in and think, oh, gosh, you know, they've got that. Oh, what do I have to do here? And I always reassure them. Yeah. We are friendly. This is just about connecting. It's about supporting other women. And that's where the magic happens. You don't have to come and feel as if you have to sell yourself. It's just about having a chat.
Absolutely. It doesn't have to be aggressive. It can be a very nice experience.
Lovely. Just to finish off, Sue, what is the one piece of advice you would give to your younger self?
That's a difficult one. What piece of advice would I give to my younger self? Have more confidence. If I'd know, everybody always thought I was very confident. I know it appeared as though I was very confident as a young person doing these many different things. But I think if I'd have had, I'm back to the 11 plus, I blame that for everything. But it takes your self-belief away. And if I'd have had that younger, how much more would I have done sooner? Who knows?
Well, it's exciting. I think you've done quite a bit. Quite soon.
I could have done more.
How would you have helped that young 11-year-old girl to have more confidence?
Well, I think I would have worked with her on understanding that one small obstacle doesn't end your life. That it is just a moment in time. One day, 3 hours, a judgment doesn't end your life. And that actually you've got lots more to offer.
Oh, yes, I love that. We have such a habit as human beings of seeing that, of thinking that our present circumstances, this is the way it's always going to be, and judging our future by where we are now, and things can change a skip of a heartbeat, can't they?
Well, it's funny, when I got my MBE, we trotted off up to Buckingham Palace, and it was Prince William did the ceremony, which I was absolutely delighted about. He's a charming young man. And we're walking through the gates of Buckingham Palace, and I had my six-year-old granddaughter with me. And I said to my husband, I think I finally got over failing my 11 plus. And he said, thank God for that. It's ridiculous, isn't it? It sounds as though it's ruined my life. It hasn't. It's just one of those things. But it's interesting. I think it's in the top of my mind at the moment as well, because of all the publicity in the papers at the moment about bringing grammar schools back in.
Yeah, but you know, on the flip side, Sue, I think it might have made your life, because it was that determination to be more than that 11 plus, wasn't it? I think that drove you on.
There's an interesting thought. You could well be right.
And we'll leave it at that. Sue Lawton, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me, Amanda. It's been a pleasure.